to our speakers. Again, we're here for the Federal Facilities Online Academy, where our topic will be Groundwater Policy and Federal Facilities Overview. We'll be joined by a number of speakers on today's session, and the first speaker who will be joining you is Emmy Laiha, who's coming from the EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, where she's an environmental scientist who works on Superfund cleanups of hazardous waste sites through that program. Her position includes implementing national policy, promoting consistency in cleanups, developing training, and developing relationships with other federal agencies and stakeholders. Before she joined that office here at EPA, Emmy was a remedial project manager for 8 years in EPA's Hanford Project Office in Richland, Washington. We'll also be joined by Ben Symes. Ben is also coming from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. Ben works in that office, pardon me while I adjust my screen here, where he is a lead on groundwater policy, adaptive management, mining contracts, and the federal agency's hazardous waste compliance. Ben is also FIFRO's representative on the Superfund National Remedy Review Board. His past work includes being a former Navy RPM consultant and START for EPA Region 9. We'll also be joined by Kate Garufi. Kate Garufi works here in the Superfund program in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where she has over 15 years of experience in EPA headquarters providing policy and technical support to all 10 regions for topics including design and remedial action scoping, project management, and groundwater policy development. In addition, she's also the chair for the Adaptive Management Task Force work group, which has conducted a number of pilot projects to support future guidance development in this area. We'll also be joined by Dave Bartenfelder, again, from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Dave has over 30 years of environmental remediation experience after joining EPA in 1991 and working in RCRA corrective action. He also joined Superfund in 2005 and has mainly worked in the areas of vapor intrusion and groundwater, specifically remedy selection, MNA, TI, and remedy completion, pardon me. Prior to working at EPA, he was also in the private sector engaged in merger and acquisition consulting and also conducting corporate environmental regulatory analysis. And then lastly, we'll be joined by Kathy Davis from EPA Region 3 in their Superfund and Emergency Management Division. Kathy is a senior hydrologist and team leader for the hydrologists in the Regional Superfund Program, where she has over 30 years of experience in providing technical support regarding the characterization and remediation of contaminated groundwater at federal facilities, PRP, and fund lead sites, with an emphasis on contaminant fate and transport and emerging contaminants, as well as DNAPLs and military-specific compounds. She also provides recommendations regarding consistent application of groundwater policy and guidance and use of technical impracticability, or TI waivers, and optimization processes for stakeholders. So with that, again, a big warm welcome to all of our presenters. And I'm going to call up presentation materials and turn things over to Emmy to get started with a brief series overview. So Emmy, if you're on the line, please feel free to get started.
Sure. Thank you, Jean. I wanted to take just a minute to talk about the Federal Facilities Academy. So this is a voluntary training program that was developed with EPA remedial project managers, as well as project managers from other federal agencies, state representatives, tribal groups. We have really great training through EPA, but we wanted to develop something that really got at the nuances of cleanup at federal facilities, which, as I'm sure many of you know, is always just a little bit different or just has a few other things that need to be considered. So we launched this academy, which is a total of 12 courses. 11 of those are webinars that are open to the public. So anyone, regardless of which group you're with or who you work for, are welcome to take those webinars. There is one in-person course that does have some limitations on who can participate. And we had a few scheduled for this year. We're in the process of finding appropriate dates to reschedule those, and those will be up on Trainix as soon as we have confirmation on new dates for those. So more to come on that. But again, this is a voluntary training program, really hoping to fill in those gaps as far as cleanups at federal facilities and just help everyone be more successful in their federal facility cleanups. I'm going to hand it back over to Jean so she can talk a little bit more about how you get credit for the 11 webinars and the in-person classroom training.
All right. Thank you. So just a quick reminder, as Emmy said, the series or entire course is going to be made up of two parts. We're going to have 11 online webinars which are open to the public, and then that one classroom delivery which has a limited audience. For the online webinars, you can participate either live online, just like you're doing right now, or you can replay recorded versions of those sessions. And again, both the live and archived versions are open to the public. For the in-person delivery, the only way to participate in that session is to actually attend a course in person when the sessions are scheduled. And remember, they do have a limited audience open to EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. In order to document your participation, for each individual one of the online webinars, whether you attend live or you replay the recorded version, you'll need to fill out an online feedback form to obtain an individual certificate. So for every webinar you attend live or replay, fill out the feedback form and you'll immediately have access to a certificate for that particular webinar. So you'll be able to get 11 separate certificates for each webinar that you either attend or replay. If you are able to do all 11 webinars and also attend that in-person classroom training, you'll then be eligible for an Academy certificate, which represents your completion of the entire series, both the online component and that in-person classroom delivery. All right, Emmy, I think that's the end of my overview. So let me call up the presentation materials and turn it back to you to get things started with our training materials today.
Great. So as Jean had already shared, today's webinar is looking at EPA Superfund groundwater policy and federal facilities as an overview. And so we're looking at how EPA Superfund groundwater policy is applied to federal facility sites listed on the National Priorities List, the NPL, under CERCLA, which is the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. There's one other thing we'd like to clarify up front. So this is an educational webinar on the existing EPA groundwater policy and guidance. There are also, in a parallel effort, some listening sessions that have been scheduled as part of the ongoing effort with the EPA Superfund Task Force. And that effort is looking at policies and any potential updated policies that may be issued. We had a listening session with other federal agencies back on May 26th as part of the effort to solicit feedback. So while this is ongoing, EPA's current groundwater policy and guidance remains unchanged. So those are still in effect, so to speak, and the listening sessions, or I believe there's a few more scheduled, but that process is ongoing, just in case people thought this was a listening session and not an educational webinar. We wanted to make that clarification up front. Okay, clarifications aside, before we jump into the content for today, we would like to get to know you all a little bit better. When I say we, I mean your instructors on today's webinar. So we'd like to do a group poll and ask what has been your biggest challenge when it comes to dealing with groundwater remedies at Superfund sites. And I think Jean will step us through how you can provide your answer to this question.
All right, so I'll draw everyone's attention to a small box that appears on the lower left of your screen. At the bottom of that left box, you can click your cursor and type your response. You can type multiple responses. So as you enter answers in, hit the Enter key, and we'll start to see responses appear in the window above. You'll be able to read through other participants' responses, and if you agree with or have also faced a challenge that you see entered by another attendee, you can hover your cursor over their answer. You'll see a plus one appear to the right of the response, and you can click on that plus one to vote or agree with that. And as more time passes and more people enter and read and vote, we'll start to see the most popular or common challenges automatically appear at the top of that list. There'll be a scroll bar on the side so that you can scroll through to see how others have answered as well. And Emmy, already I can start to see that one of these challenges seems to be pretty prevalent, and that's attaining groundwater quality ARARs within a reasonable time frame. That seems to be the biggest challenge that our attendees are facing. But I'm seeing some others there, such as remedies or treatability studies that go on for a long time, limited site characterization. People are also facing challenges here as I'm starting to see more and more votes come in lots and lots of answers are coming in, so I'm glad to get that input from everybody.
I see everything coming in, too.
Yeah. So this is great. I'm also seeing gradient sources being an issue. People are having challenges just in understanding of their site. So as I'm scrolling through some of the individual responses, there seems to be a lot of challenge in understanding site conditions, and then that's impacting their ability to work on groundwater remedies at their Superfund sites. But without a doubt, the most popular one are these remedies or treatability studies that just seem to take forever, or again, limited site characterization.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for chiming in on what challenges you face. It helps us better, prepare as presenters to know what points to emphasize as we're going through today's content. So thank you for that. And it also gives us a chance to have a sense of what mindset you all are coming in on. So super helpful. All right. So we're going to switch gears a bit here and start getting into today's content. I want to provide a little bit of background information before I hand the mic off to our next instructor, just providing some context. So on this slide here, slide 4, you're looking at a figure for selection trends for decision documents with groundwater remedies that were selected between 1982 and 2017. This figure is taken from the 2020 Superfund Remedy Report. This will be the 16th edition and should be posted online soon. I don't have an exact date, but I know it's being worked on. So it's a pretty recent figure. You'll notice that our in-situ, let me go ahead and get my arrow here so I can point that out. The in-situ treatment identified on this blue line with the squares has continued to stay pretty high. Around 53% was the 2017 value. So that has been, you know, a little more than half the time selected in groundwater remedies through decision documents. Pump and treat, which is identified here in this red line with the circles, you'll notice over time it has been decreasing since about the late 1990s, and I think the average for the last couple of years has been about 20%. So you see we've been in that 20% range for a couple of years now. It's somewhat leveled out. And then I'll just point out one more item here on this green line with the triangles, that it's been pretty consistent as far as the inclusion of institutional controls in groundwater remedies. And just to put this in more context, these values were taken based on about 2,500 decision documents and then compiled. So it gives you a sense of what's trending as far as groundwater remedies. And I'll specify this is both private and federal facility sites. All right. For our next slide, on slide 5, this is a figure that was taken from the 2013 Superfund Remedy Report. I took this just because it's easy to cite it in a document, but you can see just a quick trend in the blue. Those are the non-federal facility documents that have been issued, and then in red, we have our federal facility documents. So of these total of about 1,900 documents, 30% were for federal facilities with a groundwater decision. So just, again, sharing some context on this world of groundwater. Now we're getting to our agenda, our map for the rest of the webinar. So we'll be looking at groundwater classification, institutional controls, those groundwater response actions, M&A and PIs. We'll finish it off with remedy optimization and then a discussion on adaptive management at groundwater sites. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Ben to get us started.
All right, thanks, Emmy. So this course, our course right here, is more of an overview course of our previous guidance and documents, like Emmy mentioned. I think you could take each one of these subsections into at least a day course. So we're going to kind of go quick. I just wanted to forewarn everybody that's the pace of this course. We can always you can always work with Emmy. We can always do future courses, but that's the way this is set up. You're going to kind of notice throughout is we're going to have sources that we generally use when we interpret groundwater remediation in CERCLA. And the first source I'd like to mention right now is kind of what this course was based off of. And that's our 2009 guidance. It's called Summary of Key Existing EPA CERCLA Policies for Groundwater Restoration. It's something that I have on my desk. It's something that I refer to on an everyday basis. So you'll be seeing that as well as some other similar documents that have been definitely will be mentioned throughout this course. So I did see during that poll, groundwater classification, groundwater designation, beneficial use on some of your answers. So hopefully we can go through and we can identify any issues and maybe kind of talk through them later at the end of this class. But let's start with the basics first. So when we at EPA determine what groundwater classification is, we defer to the state future and current land use criteria and state guidelines for that first step. And how do we do that? We refer to the approved comprehensive state groundwater protection program. Those are called the KISWIPs. The next portion, if there's a KISWIP not in place, we fall back to the federal guidelines. That's the 1986 classification system. And within that system, we have class one groundwater, class two, and class three. And we'll talk about more of them in the next couple slides. I do want to point out on the right, this has been brought up into the past. We've had a dispute that went all the way to the administrator on this issue. Land use is not identified as a consideration in making groundwater classifications. You might think, oh, what does that mean? That means if you have a commercial facility, you're not going to be cleaning groundwater up to commercial values, okay? We have set criteria, cleanup levels. They don't vary with land use. So no, you know, industrial is not going to be different than it would be in a residential setting for groundwater. And that was determined in an administrator's decision. So the next slide I want to talk about is the 13 states that have an EPA endorsed KISWIP. So this is, again, it's a weird acronym. The states are there. It's an approved plan that EPA and the regions, as well as the state developed, has worked on, signed off on, agreed upon for how that groundwater classification in that state is designated. I do have a few caveats on those 13 states. We've been discussing them recently, and those are Washington State and Delaware. They actually have a caveat within their KISWIPs plans that says that it should be not used for Superfund or RCRA corrective action cleanups. So I did definitely want to mention that. The most recent approved KISWIP was Rhode Island, and it was signed off recently by EPA and the state in 2018. So it's a program that has kind of continued forward from the early 90s until today. Like I said, that's our approved criteria on how we view groundwater classification. In 1997, we released a memo that states we automatically defer to that KISWIP if it is approved. So that's the state and EPA have pre-approved it. We use that site specifically at CERCLA remedial actions as well as response actions. Next slide. So let's talk a little bit about the federal guidelines, the federal classification. So if the state does not have an approved comprehensive state groundwater protection program, a KISWIP, what do we fall back on? We talk about the federal guideline, the draft final 1986 EPA guidelines for groundwater classification. So that's an Office of Water document that Superfund has adopted on how we view groundwater classification. So we have three classes that we talk about. Class one is special groundwater. That is sole source aquifers that is equally vital. It's irreplaceable source of drinking water for communities over 2,500 people. It is, that's the special groundwater class. So the next class I want to talk about is current and potential drinking water aquifer designations. The class 2A, current saucer drinking water. To have a current source of drinking water, there's some criteria involved with that. And that's the presence of one or more water wells or springs. In addition to that, it is a water supply reservoir watershed, and that's designated by a state or local jurisdiction. I wanted to make that clear. The final one is class three, and that is reserved for groundwater that has virtually no potential of drinking water. I wanted to clarify on a couple of things, though, that, you know, groundwater will not be considered class three when contamination is due to an action present at that facility. We do have criteria set forth on that, on what a non-groundwater use aquifer is, and that's identified here in class three. So kind of taking a step back on that, the NCP states that groundwater is a valuable resource, and it should be protected and restored if necessary and practicable. It also states that EPA must clarify groundwater for Superfund action, that classification is only used to determine the scope of site-specific remedial actions. I kind of wanted to call out the site-specific portion of this. I also wanted to mention if a state does not have an approved KISWIP, such as the 37 states, the 39 that don't use it for Superfund, then the first portion applies. We will definitely consider those classifications and their applicability in the selection of an appropriate remedy. Now, however, if they are less stringent, then we're going to just default to the EPA classification, sometimes depending on the geographic location. States might kind of push more towards a less stringent remedy selection with that. So right now we're going to jump into a knowledge question. If the EPA groundwater classification system, what is Class 1 groundwater? So I'm seeing some answers come in now.
That's right. And so you all have access to a small poll in the bottom corner. Simply click the circle to the answer to the left of the answer that you think is correct. For anyone on a mobile device, if you're unable to see that content, you can type it into the Q&A window. I'll be happy to take a look at your responses. But just quickly, you can see the options on the slide there. So just you can type in A, B, C, or D into the Q&A window if you are on a mobile device. But Ben, in looking at this, I think I'm starting to see a pretty prevalent trend where the audience knows the answer is.
No, and the answer here is special groundwater. It's an irreplaceable source of drinking water, sole source aquifer, high value, ecologically vital. So, yeah, definitely great job to the group in getting those concepts. So the next section I'm going to talk about is institutional controls. And I have
Ben, before we move on to that, did you want to check and see if there's any questions that came in about groundwater classification?
I haven't here.
No, okay. I meant to check with Jean.
Got it.
Yeah, and we do have just a few questions that came in. And so this first one is asking about how this applies. The participant notes, how does this apply to aquifers that have different characteristics with depth? For example, a lot of times contamination is in the upper aquifer or the stratigraphic zone, and it does not produce well. And then the deeper, more productive aquifers are used for drinking water or agricultural water supplies. So can you talk a little bit about applicability with aquifer variations?
Yeah, I think that definitely means it's a site-specific decision. So whatever our world is at, whether it be horizontally or vertically, within the possible zone of contamination that we have, is where would we define the aquifer itself. So, yes, you can have different categories of aquifer at different depths for that project that you might have. And in addition to that, we'll talk kind of later on, you know, you would have different remediation technologies for those different depths in the groundwater remediation phase.
Okay. And I see a question, but we may come back to this later, so I'll just bring it up now, Ben, and if you want to punt it to later in the session, let me know. One of the attendees asked, what is the role of the OU site-specific use and value determinations when you're evaluating or selecting a CERCLA remedy?
Okay, and I think that Kathy will be talking about groundwater remediation, and Emmy will be talking about a selection of remedies farther on the course. So let's hold back on that and see if that question gets answered. But we can definitely have that at the end, Jean.
Okay, thank you.
So all right, the next section, is institutional controls here. I wanted to just kind of get two main points out of this. The NCP preamble states that the baseline assessment is essentially an evaluation of no action alternatives, including ICs. So while ICs are not actively cleaning up the contamination at its site, they can control exposure and therefore is considered to be limited action alternative. So what does this mean? Okay, what does this mean? This means if we have ICs that are blanket over a facility or a factory, that does not change the groundwater classification or basis of action at the site. So if it is a class one or class two aquifer and we would like beneficial use restoration at the site, just because ICs are presently in place, that's not how we evaluate that. So that was one of the key aspects I wanted to kind of bring out in roles of ICs in remedy selection kind of before we jump into that, and then the role of ICs in our remedy components of that. So the next slide I have talks about the role of ICs. The use of institutional control shall not substitute for active response measures as the sole remedy unless such active measures are determined to not to be practicable based on the balancing criteria. So we encourage ICs in order to prevent current or future exposures to contaminated groundwater during implementation of groundwater remedies. So having ICs on does not get you out of the groundwater remediation or groundwater classification or beneficial use. It just aids in prevention of exposure. So there's limited, very, very limited circumstances when an IC-only remedy is applicable. We could talk about them later, but it would be definitely where a source control action has definitely already been achieved, and you've decided that groundwater remediation might not be practical at that moment. We consider ICs not an active remedy. We also consider groundwater monitoring not an active remedy. So if you are thinking about a remedy that is IC only with groundwater monitoring, there's a headquarters consultation in place for the regions. For them to approach us with. So that's the other key point I wanted to get out of. So now, Kathy, I'm going to shift this part of the presentation over to you, and you're going to be doing the groundwater response actions.
Thank you, Ben. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to join all of you today. And we'll start with the next slide here, groundwater response actions. So once an unacceptable risk from groundwater has been determined, a response action is necessary, and it should be protective of human health and the environment. CERCLA states that such remedial action shall require a level or standard of control which at least attains maximum contaminant level goals, which were established under the Safe Drinking Water Act, and water quality criteria established under the Clean Water Act. Groundwater restoration, NCP states that EPA expects to return usable groundwaters to their beneficial uses wherever practicable within a time frame that is reasonable given the particular circumstances of the site. So as Ben was talking about in terms of determining the beneficial use of the aquifer in which the contamination is, it's basically the first cut is the physical attributes of the aquifer. Can it produce enough water, 150 gallons per day? Does it exceed 10,000 parts per million milligrams per liter TDS? And does it have widespread contamination, or does it have contamination that cannot be treated by typical surface or water supply methods? And so it's where's the contamination within the groundwater, and that groundwater aquifer, does it meet the criteria for the different classification systems? When restoration to beneficial use is not practicable, EPA expects to prevent further migration of the plume, prevent exposure to the contaminated groundwater, and evaluate further risk reduction. How can that plume be reduced in size and volume and toxicity? So principles for groundwater restoration. If groundwater that's a current or potential source of drinking water is contaminated above protective levels, a remedial action under CERCLA should seek to restore that aquifer to beneficial use. Groundwater contamination should not be allowed to migrate and further contaminate the aquifer or other media. So this would include vapor intrusion into buildings, contamination of sediment, surface waters, including wetlands. Keep in mind that when referring to a site, the CERCLA definition of a site is where contamination has come to be located, and it is not dependent on property boundaries. If the ARARs cannot be met, there are six ways to waive ARARs, and technically, a technical impracticability waivers from an engineering perspective are the most commonly used ones. Early actions should be considered as soon as possible. These include such things as source removal, plume containment, or provision of an alternate water supply. IC, as Ben just said, should be used until the groundwater meets cleanup goals, and ICs should not be relied as the only response to contaminated groundwater, just as Ben just talked about. Now, Emmy's going to provide a different perspective. Emmy, would you like to talk about DOD guidance?
Yes, thank you. So we wanted to share some excerpts from DOD and DOE guidance as part of this webinar, just to help those who are working in site teams at federal facilities understand what might be potential sources of friction. If we're using different playbooks, so to speak, it makes sense that those playbooks might not necessarily work well together or work 100% well together. So we wanted to take a second to highlight NCP expectations in DOD, Department of Defense guidance. And this is taken from the 2012 Defense Environmental Restoration Program, or DERP manual. And you'll notice here on first blush of the language, it seems like, okay, we're on the same page. I'll highlight here where we have that if remedial action for groundwater is necessary to protect human health and the environment, then the DOD component should consider, I'm going to leave the arrow right there, the NCP expectation that usable groundwaters will be returned to their beneficial uses wherever practicable. Again, what does practicable mean? That has been debated at many of our sites within a time frame that is reasonable. Also, another phrasing that has led to quite a bit of disagreement across trying to move forward with cleanup decisions at our federal facility sites. So while this site, a specific subpart of the NCP, when we have this phrase should consider, maybe you can see that that might lead to some issues. Does that mean shall consider, must consider, or is it optional? EPA doesn't see meeting the NCP as optional. But I just want to highlight here that can be a source of disagreement. If you are a regulatory representative and you're working with your counterparts in a DOD component, Army, Air Force, Navy, what have you, it might be that you're speaking slightly different languages or your jargon is just a little bit different between your regulatory agencies and that lead cleanup agency. On this second part, I want to highlight when it's saying when restoration to beneficial uses is not practicable, EPA expects, you know, these following items. But on the sub-bullet here where we say if AWARs cannot be met, the DOD should appropriately justify an AWAR waiver. I'll say that bullet or that one sentence in the manual makes it seem almost like, well, DOD will get to decide and justify an AWAR waiver, and that will be the end of it. But that's EPA is involved in that process, involved in approvals of AWAR waivers, and that isn't really clarified here. So again, just wanted to share this information in case you are engaged in argument at one of these DOD sites. It might help you understand why that is. And I'll hand it back over to Kathy for our next slide.
Thanks, Emmy. So the groundwater remediation and a phased approach. So maybe this slide will help with those two topics that were seemed to be the most prevalent in the polls about limited site characterization and remedies or studies that tend to drag on. So groundwater remediation phased approach is really a good approach to take the information that's gained through site investigation, through studies, through treatability studies and pilot tests, and build upon that conceptual site model to go forward with the next step of the process. So it includes such things as early and interim actions, perhaps the process that some people refer to as a treatment train. But basically, it's to do some work, gain a better understanding, and take that information and build upon it. So there's a lot of benefits to this. It can be used for better characterization because there's not a long characterization process and choosing a remedy and then going back to see, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen, that during implementation of the remedy, the source can reveal itself at that point, and then it goes back to more site investigation, or perhaps recalcitrant areas of the plume don't clean up, and there are other sources out there. It takes that iteration and puts it on a time frame that can be used to facilitate the process. So data could be used for better characterization, which then in turn feeds into better assessment of potential remedial actions. I'm sure we're all very aware through many studies that the subsurface is rarely what we expect when we start doing interrogation into the aquifers. This allows greater flexibility to respond to site conditions. The more information, the better the remedy, the quicker and cheaper to attain cleanup goals. And it can prevent the need from going back and recharacterizing areas. So there's a lot of possibilities and a lot of benefits with a phased remediation approach. So the basis for the CERCLA action, again, it's the unacceptable risk. It's been determined through the risk assessment. And then the two threshold criteria for remedial action, which I think people are familiar with, is the first one, it has to be protective of human health and the environment. And secondly, it needs to meet ARARs or waive ARARs. And again, we go back to the groundwater restoration beneficial use groundwater classification system. The extent of contamination, typically when a site is listed, there has to be some sort of area where the release or releases were found. And this is usually a geographical description. And it's within the installation or the plant boundaries. And the site is usually referenced to that particular area. But in Superfund, in CERCLA, it says that the site is actually where the contamination has come to be located. And so the area of the site could grow as a result of the information gathered during the investigation study, and because it's where the contamination is. And that can extend past installation or property boundaries. So groundwater ARARs to consider, maximum contaminant level, MCLGs, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, or non-zero MCLGs. Water quality criteria under the Clean Water Act. And this is not a comprehensive list, obviously. There are other ARERs to consider. In fact, there's a whole list, including state, location-specific, chemical-specific, et cetera. But the idea is, again, it's to look at the ARERs in terms of the MCLs, the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act for surface water. So we're going to do another poll here. Jean, if you want to jump in, I'll read the question. So which is not true? So there's one that's not true when addressing groundwater contamination at CERCLA sites.
All right. And so now the audience should have a box that appears on the bottom left of their screen with those four options labeled A through D. And you can simply click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct. Again, if you are just on a mobile device and can't see that, you can always type in A, B, C, or D into the Q&A window. You can log your information that way. And for those of you who have been typing in with questions, please know we do see them. I am queuing them up. I appreciate that. And we will pause again shortly. But, Kathy, I'm looking and I'm seeing a pretty heavy trend here where the bulk of the audience seems to be focusing on the last option, option D, that institutional controls can be relied upon as the only response to contaminated groundwater or as justification for not taking action under CERCLA. So is that not true?
Overwhelmingly correct, yes. ICs should not be relied on as the only response to contaminated groundwater or as a justification for not taking action under CERCLA. To ensure protective remedies, CERCLA response actions for contaminated groundwater should generally address all pathways of exposure that pose an actual or potential risk to human health and the environment. Excellent. Next slide. Okay, there is a provision in the statute that talks about alternate concentration limits. And it says that alternate concentration limits, or ACLs, this is under Superfund and not RCRA, may not be used if the process assumes a point of human exposure beyond the boundary of the facility, except where, one, there are known and projected points of entry of such groundwater into surface water, two, on the basis of measurements or projections, there is or will be no statistically significant increase of such constituents from groundwater in the surface water at the point of entry or at any point where there is reason to believe accumulation of constituents may occur downstream. And three, the remedial action includes enforceable measures that will preclude human exposure to the contaminated groundwater. In 2005, EPA headquarters issued a memo on clarification of the ACLs. This was to provide guidance on the proper use of ACLs and Superfund remedies. It expanded on the factors and criteria for guiding the use of ACLs in CERCLA. Seven additional site-specific factors were added to the original three, and two additional clarifications were noted on the use of ACLs. ACLs are directed to substitute for standards that are applicable and meet certain criteria. So an example of this would be state requirements to clean up to background, and that ACLs cannot be used when a relevant and appropriate standard exists, such as MCLs or water quality criteria. Now, interestingly enough, if you look through the guidance documents, there's just a word of caution, because there appeared to be a transcription error. And many of the guidance documents have an error and say they're known or projected points of entry into the surface water instead of known and projected points of entry into the surface water. It appears that perhaps one guidance document said this, and then it was propagated through other guidance documents. So when referring to that, I just keep in mind that it's known and projected points of entry of contaminated groundwater into surface water. So we've talked about the degree of cleanup, ARERs, MCLs. I think one of the big questions I always get is, so where do these cleanup levels need to be met within the groundwater? And in Superfund, there's what's referred to as the area of attainment. And so it's throughout the plume of contamination. The groundwater cleanup levels need to be met throughout the plume of contamination. Now, if there are still waste that remains in place, such as a landfill, the cleanup levels do not need to be met underneath the landfill, but they need to be met at the boundary of the landfill or where waste remains in place and then throughout the plume of contamination. Okay. Remediation timeframe. This is always a popular topic, and nobody likes the answer because it's site-specific. It really is site-specific. It's in terms of how fast does the groundwater move, what's the size of the plume, what are the contaminant fate and transport properties, what's the use of the groundwater in and near the plume, what are the factors of and influencing groundwater flow direction in and near the plume. There are many, many things, and the time frames are all dependent on that. So EPA's preference is for, well, restore the aquifer as soon as you can, as practicable. For Class 1 groundwater aquifers, the special groundwater that you answered in Ben's poll, and groundwaters that are currently or very likely to be used in the near term as a source of drinking water. So an extended remediation time frame is where there's some flexibility. So it can be appropriate where contaminated groundwaters are not expected to be used in the near term and where alternative sources are available. However, that's not to say that there's no action, again, because restoration to beneficial use is the ultimate objective for groundwater remediation. But there may be some flexibilities in terms of the time frame that may be specific to your site. So I would suggest early and frequent discussions with the stakeholders to discuss any of these types of topics. And when am I done? That's the other question I get. I've reached my MCL. Am I done? So a few years ago, EPA issued guidance on talking about the completion, evaluating completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. And it recommends evaluating a contaminant of concern on a well-by-well basis. Because remember, where the groundwater cleanup levels need to be met is throughout the area of attainment, throughout the plume, so that would be on a well-by-well basis. So there's two types of monitoring. There's remediation monitoring, and there's attainment monitoring. So remediation monitoring phase is the phase where the remedial actions are being implemented. And during this phase, groundwater sampling and monitoring data is usually collected. So once all the COCs and the wells have met their cleanup levels, then you can say, well, it's been remediated. So the data needs to be there to support that from a statistical standpoint. Once it's determined that the cleanup levels have indeed been met, the next phase is attainment and monitoring. And that means what's going to happen after you say that it's cleaned up. Is there going to be rebound? Is there a concern in terms of will it stay like that and consistently meet cleanup levels for all COCs in the future? So that's the attainment monitoring phase. Again, a statistical analysis of meeting the cleanup goals. So for another topic, I will turn it over to Dave Bartenfelder in terms of monitor natural attenuation.
All right, thank you, Kathy. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Yeah, the next topic is monitor natural attenuation, which is a commonly used activity in Superfund cleanups, but it's also a commonly misunderstood mechanism process in Superfund cleanups that a lot of questions surround. So in this short presentation, we'll go ahead and try and clarify some of the aspects of monitor natural attenuation. So in the use of M&A, M&A has been dubbed a passive approach to Superfund cleanups, but by no means is it a no-action approach. This is an alternative, an option, in part of your arsenal of remedial activities for achieving your remedial action objective of restoration that pulls on natural processes that are involved in the environment and taking advantage of them. And these use and do not preclude the use of active remediation at other parts of the site or is a precursor to M&A. So you might do something actively to set the stage for M&A and then let M&A go and take its role in restoring the groundwater. Or in one part of the site, you would have to use active, but for one part of the site, there are natural processes involved that will allow you to use M&A to meet your remediation goal. So as Kathy was talking about just before this, there's this whole issue of time frame, and time frame is an important factor that plays into the use of M&A. M&A can be used in, as we said, many situations. It can be used as a single remedial action or in combination with other remedial actions. And with regard to the time frame for M&A is that M&A should, in the grand scheme of things, have a reasonable time frame compared to other methods and especially other active methods. It might not have to be exactly the same time frame for meeting your remedial goals, but it should be able to do it in the ballpark. So in general, the remediation time frame for M&A might be a little bit longer, but there are other benefits associated with using M&A compared to something more active. And there's no magical date, as Kathy mentioned, with regards to what is appropriate for M&A. It is a site-specific determination, and what might be justified for M&A at one site might not be justified for using M&A in another site, as Kathy described in the previous slides. So the other thing here is the interplay between M&A and technically impracticable. The use of M&A does not mean it's technically impractical to restore. It's just another tool in the toolbox that says, hey, you know, we do have these other methods that are not active that we can still meet our restoration standards. So that's probably the biggest difference and distinction between M&A and technical impracticability. So with the use of M&A, as I mentioned, it can be used in a diverse spectrum of situations. It can be used as if the situations present themselves specific to the site, that M&A is robust enough that it might be the only thing that you need to get from your initial concentration all the way to meeting your remedial action objectives. In other situations, because of circumstances, M&A might not be viable throughout the whole spectrum of the contamination and the conditions in the subsurface geology or what M&A can achieve because of the biological activity or resorptive capacity or other things that are associated with it. So it might be a nice polishing step after you do take an initial play at an active technology, and then as you get close to your remedial action objective standard, you might be able to convert over to an M&A type technology. And M&A, as I said, is a broad, diverse tool that we can use, that there are many processes and mechanisms that play into our definition in Superfund for M&A. And we've listed some of them here: biodegradation, dilution dispersion, adsorption, radioactive decay, and there are others. All these are possible, and all of them can be justified with lines of evidence. We do in the Superfund program do have a preference for the mechanisms that tend to destroy and degrade, but we can use the other mechanisms that are included in as the options. So there are many pros and cons that are associated with M&A, and I'm not going to go through all of them. We have a whole list of pros and cons. I'm just going to highlight some of the, you know, the bigger pros and maybe some of the bigger cons. As far as the pros go, it's less intrusive. It can be used in conjunction with other activities. And a lot of times people really, you know, glom onto the notion that there's potentially lower remedial costs. And that's fine. The big thing is that M&A doesn't get you away from restoration. It just takes it in a different path and under different rates and conditions. Some of the cons associated with M&A is it is a larger time frame. So you have to play into and consider, factor in, what is in your site-specific situation. If you are in a aquifer in a large city with a high demand for the groundwater's natural resource, M&A might not be appropriate for that. And many times, not always, the characterization that goes into an M&A might be a little bit more complex. It might be a little bit more costly. And for dealing with the chlorinated solids, one of the things you always have to worry about is, as we go for the degradation transformation, going to vinyl chloride as a byproduct of M&A is a more toxic value, and that is a concern. We will probably also be involved in longer-term monitoring, and there's a cost associated with that because your M&A process might and will be slower than what you would have for an active remediation. And then another thing to consider is, how do you educate and reach out to the general public on the merits of M&A? Most people can understand better if you're going to do in situ chemical oxidation or thermal, but when you talk about M&A, people's appreciation or understanding of what M&A is not quite as great. So sometimes a little bit more education and outreach is needed to identify that this M&A will be a viable and effective method to restore groundwater to beneficial use. So we talked about these mechanisms, and to justify M&A, the guidance goes on to say we really need to have support of what are called lines of evidence. And it's a three-tiered approach that is involved in M&A for Superfund sites. So, you know, one is an indirect that you need to show a general decreasing trend in contaminant mass and concentration over time. You're making progress to achieving your remedial action objective. And this can be using statistics, you know, showing maps of different wells and how the plume is decreasing and how it is decreasing with time. Another option is another indirect method where you look at other like geochemical type processes and factors that play into, are you in the right kind of conditions? If you're going to be looking at reductive dechlorination for organic chlorinated solvents, you want to be under reducing conditions. You have a highly oxidizing condition, it's probably not the right situation for that mechanism. And the other one is, do you have the microorganisms, if you're going to do a biodegradation type situation, that if you don't have the right microbes, it's not there. If you're going to do something more in lines for inorganics, you might want to show, do you have the absorptive capacity, the assimilative capacity to keep the contaminants, you know, out of the solution or released at a very slow rate that the natural environment can handle below the remedial action objective. So at this point, I'd like to go ahead and turn it back over to Emmy to give a few slides on other federal facility perspectives.
Thanks, Dave. So we wanted to look for a second at other guidance that may have a big impact on how other federal agencies approach groundwater remediation. So we want to take a second here to look at DOE guidance on M&A. And here, DOE is also advocating a tiered decision-making approach. In fact, this document, the Decision-Making Framework Guide, states that it is in support of the principles that were presented in EPA's 1999 M&A guidance. So it seems like we're on the same page, right, at least to start. So there's agreement about this tiered approach. In this case, the guidance for DOE says that these tiers are structured to streamline the M&A evaluation process while ensuring site resources are expended wisely. So where some of the changes, or I would say opportunities for disagreement arise, are in the details, right? So in this tiered one boxes, I know it's a little bit hard to read, but again, the document is cited at the bottom of the slide if you're interested in pulling it up yourself. So here we have, if you're looking for these characteristics at a site, that contamination currently is not posing an unacceptable risk, and there's no active source term, and the plume contours are static or retreating, If you have those characteristics, then ideally you could go to the next tier, which would be to actually start doing that alternate evaluation and selection of technical analysis. So the argument there, at least being presented here, the playbook is that you would look at these characteristics, or if say you don't have a long history of monitoring at that site, you would look at the data you do have to see if it suggests that attenuation mechanisms are operating or do exist. So that sounds good. Like, okay, it sounds like we're in the same realm, but it, like I said, that's when you decide whether a site should be considered for M&A, if the characteristics you're looking for are slightly different, note this doesn't read the way we were just talking about M&A lines of evidence on the previous slide that Dave was talking about. So it just allows that opportunity to start on divergent paths when moving forward, trying to select your groundwater remedy. So again, just wanted to highlight that our playbooks are a little bit different. At first blush, they seem to be on the same page, but when you start getting into the details, you can begin to diverge away from each other. So I'll go ahead and pass it. Oh, actually, before I pass it back to Dave, I wanted to look at some key considerations from this guidance. Like, okay, what is tier one versus tier two and so on? So here, like I mentioned, you have these characteristics of not posing risk, no active source term, to determine whether or not you go to this technical analysis to determine the time frame needed for M&A. And then here, if DOE considers anticipated future land and groundwater use, how is that factoring into the equation? I think this might be where we have a lot of disagreement between regulatory agencies and DOE and this topic right there with how that water is going to be used and when, if at all, moving into the future. And then this distance to potential receptors could be an opportunity for discussion or disagreement as well. And with that, I'll go ahead and pass it back to Dave.
Okay, thanks, Emmy. Can I ask Jean something really quick? Before we get into TI, do we have time for any questions on M&A?
Sure. We do have a number of questions that have come in on M&A. And I'm going to start.
Jean, one quick thing. Before we get into the first question, there's one other thing I want to add.
Okay.
And when I started off the presentation, I talked about there's some misunderstandings about M&A. And one of the misunderstandings I just would like to bring home just real quickly is what chemical classes can M&A be used for? A lot of times we kind of dwell on the use of M&A for organics, especially the chlorinated solvents. And a lot of the 1999 M&A guidance talks about that, but it also does talk about other applications for inorganics and radionuclides. And in 2015, we did put out some additional guidance to better present how you could use M&A for inorganics and radionuclides. So just want to say that, and then we still have time for comments, questions.
Oh, okay. So there's a lot of questions that have come in here. But I'm going to start with this first one, where one of the attendees wants to know, can compound-specific isotope analysis, or CSIA, be used as a line of evidence?
I think it can, and it has been, and I think we've accepted that analysis in the past as a line of evidence to justify M&A.
Okay. All right. What about when you're defining plume areas? One of the attendees wanted clarification. When we're talking about plumes, are we defining the area as in like the cleanup level or area where you're looking at background and area to non-detect?
I think we're looking at the plume as the situation where the groundwater concentrations for specific compounds are greater than our cleanup level, whether it's an ARAR or risk-based. That's the general concept. We do also have the concept that we do not clean up below background. So that has to be factored into the logic also. So just because a level is below a set MCL, if background is higher, we're not going to clean up to less than the background level.
So, Dave, can I jump in here for a sec?
Sure.
So those are two important concepts. At least the risk assessors look at the background concentrations when they do the risk assessment. And if the plume is incorporating constituents that have background levels. And then, as you said before, the cleanup levels are different. They're once the plume and the risk have been evaluated and the constituents, and that they discuss the presence of any of those constituents in background, then it goes forward to looking at the preliminary remedial goals and the contaminants of concern and what would be the cleanup levels. So, as you said, we wouldn't likely clean up to background, but would incorporate them in the original risk assessment.
Thanks, Kathy.
Okay. And Dave, I think we'll take one more question. And this one, just specifically for MNA, one of the attendees wants to know exactly how many samples can be taken to prove that the well is definitely trending towards MNA. And, you know, they just note that they've had a lot of disagreement amongst their stakeholders. So they're wondering if you have any insights on that.
I don't know that we have an exact number. Kathy mentioned just before MNA about the approaches for the remediation phase and the attainment phase. And I think if you go to the 2014 groundwater completion guidance, even though it's designated mainly for completion and when you're done, there's some really good information in there that you can use to set up and, you know, use the statistics and use the general approach to look at the decreasing trend as to, you know, to show that you are moving towards that decreasing trend and M&A would be viable. We generally, you know, would like upwards of 8 or more samples to go ahead and capture seasonality and other things in making a decision, but there is not a hard and fast rule on the number of samples. But I think reasonably based on statistics and field conditions and what we know about the subsurface environment, you know, in general, 8 samples, give or take, would be appropriate, but that's a site-specific decision based on the conditions at the site that need to be negotiated and discussed, you know, between all the parties.
Okay. So I do have a lot of other questions in the queue from other segments as well, so I just wanted to acknowledge for the attendees, if you asked a question earlier on a previous topic, please know we haven't lost you. We will be pausing later on. So I think just in the interest of time, Dave, why don't we move on to the next segment?
Okay.
I'll encourage the audience, keep sending those questions in, and we will continue to pause for more Q&A breaks.
All right. Thanks, Jean. All right. The next topic is technical and practicability waivers. So TI waivers are a unique beast, as we all well know, and it's been raised earlier in this presentation that Superfund recognized from its inception that we cannot restore groundwater to beneficial use in all situations. And to account for that, there were 6 ARAR waivers that were identified that could be used in proper situations. TI is one of those 6. It happens to be the one that is mostly used and has the most guidance on how to use of all the waivers that are out there. So the big thing with TI waivers is it's appropriate when you cannot meet an ARAR, when it's technically impractical from an engineering perspective to achieve an ARAR. So that's the overall mantra for technical impractability. There's going to be some subtleties that we'll get through, go through as you go farther into the presentation. But one of the things also to consider is that the remedy must still be protective of human health and the environment. And this is going to play back to what Ben talked about earlier, that you might not be able to meet the ARAR, you will take actions. It might be source actions. It might be some groundwater action still. And then you might still have to use ARRs to maintain the protectiveness of the remedy. And also the ICBUs to prevent people from drinking the water that you have deemed to be non-protective. So a little bit of background information on ARR waivers. Throughout the history of the ARR waivers, and that goes back to the mid-80s, where we had the 1993 guidance actually give guidance, is that we have about 105 TI waivers, maybe a little bit more. There's always some more coming in. By and large, most of the TI waivers have been for groundwater, and our guidance is for groundwater. We do have some technical practicable waivers for surface water, because once again, we can waive anything that has an ARAR, and we do have surface water ARRs. So there is about a dozen surface water ARRs and about a handful of ARR waivers that do have a combination of groundwater and surface water components. But by and large, it's a groundwater mechanism. So the TI waivers are really based on the inability to meet ARRs. So for contaminant chemicals and their physical properties, it might be we have no technology that's available. We might be in a subsurface geologic situation where it is impossible. Not to say that the mere presence of fracture bed or karst or complex sedimentary deposits will equate to TI, but they can factor in, and they do factor into the overall decision as you're putting your lines of evidence, once again, into justifying a TI waiver. And do we actually have effective remedial technologies and strategies to address TI waivers? If we don't, if they are ineffective, that is a line of evidence for not being able to meet our restoration goal and do a TI waiver. And there's a subtlety here that it's an ineffective remedial technology, and it's not a remedial technology that is poorly installed and operated. That is not a justification for a TI waiver. The other thing is our long remedial time frame, because once again, this is part of an engineering perspective on TI. And in the 1993 guidance, we have a parenthetical of 100 years, and that's a general guide. It's not to be used as if I'm going to restore in 99 years, it's non-TI. And if it's going to take 101 years, that is a TI. There is latitude there, and site-specific conditions, as we've heard about many times earlier, could move that time frame either to less time frame based on situations maybe of demographics, populations, groundwater resource use, or further out just because of the nature of how long it is, because it's an extremely large groundwater plume, very complex. The other thing I like to mention quickly is, since it was also from the engineering perspective before getting into the waivers, is cost. We might be able to have a good handle on a contaminant, the subsurface environment might be accommodating, and we might have the technology. They all are great. But if the remediation is going to be of a cost that is astronomical, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, then it might be technically impractical to go ahead and look at the waiver at that case. Cost is not the primary driver for TIs, it's a subordinate factor. Our first goal is to be protective, but then cost does come into play. And even though we might not be able to restore, we might have to go ahead and contain, we might have to do source reduction and use ICs. But cost does play, but it is secondary. So to give you a general feel for TI waivers, this great mystical beast over the life of the program is, as I said earlier, we've done about 105 TI waivers, and they kind of ebb and flow over time. Don't really know if you can attribute to anything in particular. There is some guidance correlations, but nothing specific. Of the TI waivers that we have out there, of the 105, 11 of the waivers are at federal facilities. And in this slide, it shows you a breakdown of the TI waivers per region. Now, there is a correction here that I do need to make because this information is a little bit data. As it shows here, all the regions except Region 4 have TI waivers. Region 4 has zero. That's not the case anymore. Region 4 also does have a few TI waivers in the last couple of years. So they are in sync with everyone else, and it's just things present themselves in their own time and their own doing. So how do we use TI waivers? TI waivers may always be considered, and they can be used under appropriate circumstances at the site when you go through the criteria that's been laid out and it is deemed to be impracticable and is supported by technical information and policy and is clearly documented. And recently we did a clarification, and I'll talk about that more a little bit later. But in general, to get a TI waiver requires a review process, and there is a TI consultation in place for headquarters. So the TI waiver will be developed. It will work its way through the regional offices and headquarters. And then at that point, if it is accepted, then it will be memorialized in a decision document, a ROD amendment, something like that. But the consultation itself does not equate to granting a TI waiver. So I mentioned we did a clarification in 2016. It's mainly on process, but it also does distill some of the 1993 guidance into a checklist and does bring some of the information easier to read and more in line. So what we're looking at is we're honing in on a couple main areas. The specific ARRs that we're going to be waiving or media cleanup standards. The feasibility, we're looking at the spatial extent of TI decisions, the vertical and horizontal extent of the contamination we're going to waiver. Ben has kind of talked about this a little bit earlier, and this is really important because a TI waiver is not an all or nothing situation. You may have multiple TI waivers at a site, and you might have a TI waiver in different aquifers. It might be a shallow aquifer in one time. It might be a deeper aquifer in another case. It all depends on the technical justification for why you cannot meet your cleanup standards for a part of the plume. And one of the things that we always try to reinforce and affirm is the development of a good conceptual site model. Conceptual site models are living, breathing things that they evolve as we go through the process. I think Kathy mentioned earlier that we learn a lot, and when we do our phased approach, sometimes we do our best characterization is when we're actually doing our remediation. So things can change. We've had TIs that have modified over time based on information. Sometimes it was less than we originally thought. Sometimes it was a little bit more because something new was found. So these kinds of things happen. So the conceptual site model is paramount. So we do have a TI evaluation checklist. It's one of the appendices to the 2016 clarification. And it's a helpful tool to guide one through the best and easiest way of looking at the potential for a TI waiver. So you're going to look at the restoration potential, you know, source control measures. How are you, is your remedial action performance going on? What is your time frame? Are there other applicable technologies? What is the cost associated with it that we've talked about before? One of the things that we tend to sometimes forget about is this whole notion of the alternate remedial strategy. So even though we cannot restore the groundwater in portions of the plume, what are we going to do to have an alternate remedial strategy? Once again, TI is not a do-nothing mechanism. So that could be we are going to rely heavily on source control. We are going to do containment. We are going to do maybe some other practices in lieu of not being able to restore groundwater to the beneficial use. And there might be additional considerations that we would go ahead. Shorter remedial timeframes to reduce exposure to the populations if there is that kind of emphasis for a particular in a particular area. So the last slide I think I have on this is overall, what are the kind of chemicals that we, you know, wave? And by and large, it's the volatile organic compounds, the chlorinated solvents. We do have a fair amount of TIs for metals, PAHs and semivols, and then, even smaller numbers for PCBs, pesticides, and dioxins. So this just kind of gives you a general idea of what's going on. But this is just only one part of the equation. It's the chemical, it's the subsurface environment, and the technologies that would be appropriate for the situation. And sometimes you have a technology that works in one subsurface geologic setting and another one that doesn't work in another geologic setting for a particular chemical. So it's not a simple process to think about. It has to be well thought out as one goes ahead. So at this point, I guess I will turn it over to Emmy, unless we have any time for questions at this point.
Dave, I just think in the interest of time, why don't we go ahead and move forward to Emmy's segment, and we'll pause later on for questions.
Okay, good enough. Thanks.
All right. So next we're on to remedy optimization. Here we go. So this is based on EPA guidance from 2013 on remediation optimization definition, scope, and approach. And it gets to pointing out that optimization can be an effort that's used at any phase of the remedial response to either improve the effectiveness and or cost efficiency of that response. And it may also improve the remedy's protectiveness and the long-term implementation, which may actually facilitate progress towards site completion. So all of that sounds good, right? Let's try and do this better, maybe faster or more effectively than what we're currently doing. Some questions are, though, how do I do optimization at my site? What should I look at? So regions may use a systematic site review by a team of independent technical experts that can help identify those opportunities for improvements, or there might be other approaches that could be used to identify opportunities for greater efficiency and effectiveness. So there's more than one way to go about this. When it comes to groundwater, though, groundwater remedies may benefit from optimization efforts due to the long-term nature of the response. You know, sometimes these can go on for years or maybe even decades. So revisiting what you're doing and looking for any potential changes that could be made because of changes to the conceptual site model may be a good starting point to see if optimization is good for your site. So looking a little more closely at this, when you're considering remediation optimization, you're looking at things like improving protectiveness, effectiveness. Maybe it'll be a technical improvement or something that helps us get closer to site completion, which will get us closer to closure and effectively reducing our environmental footprint at the site. So that's the lens you're wearing when you're looking at optimization. If you're doing this type of review, it's going to consider the goals of the remedy, what data are currently available, the conceptual site model, is it fully up to date, does it need to be updated, and then looking at remedy performance and ultimately your exit strategy. So in doing all of those things for your review, you're going to be, you or your team, or if you have independent consultants doing the work, are going to be examining the site documents, talking to stakeholders, looking at all the available data, and then developing findings and recommendations on how to move forward. And ideally, that would be compiled into a report. And let's look a little bit about how the structure of that report would look on the next slide here. We're on slide, what is it, 54. So this is just a quick graphic taken from this 2013 guidance. And you can see there's all these opportunities for optimization. It's not only in the long-term response action. It's not only in O&M. This is something you can start try to consider from your RI, in the remedial investigation or your feasibility study. There's opportunities to look at ways to do it better, essentially, and you have your key components, with the center one being that conceptual site model. It is so important to understand what's happening at your site, to have enough data to understand what the processes are, because if you don't have that, you're, you know, flying blind a bit in trying to identify any opportunities for optimization. As I mentioned, a report that would be generated from this effort, and here's a typical outline of what that should look like. You'd have your executive summary, general site background, and you get into the summary of the characterization or those remediation objectives that are leading your effort. You'll have any findings from document reviews, the data analysis, and interviews that were done, and that'll all get summed up into recommendations, including the expected costs, savings, and any other implications that address critical data gaps, remedy implementation, protectiveness and costs, and so on. So here's your little roadmap if you're considering optimization at your site, the kind of report that would be generated. And essentially, this is what the team would go back to and make sure you're on the same page as far as what changes can be made and where does it make sense to move forward for what's happening at your site. And again, when you have a long-term implementation, like for you do for groundwater remedies, most of the time there may be a lot of opportunities to go back and consider optimization. So I wanted to touch again on what other agencies may be using to guide their efforts as far as optimization goes. And DOE has some guidance from 2002 for optimizing groundwater response actions at DOE sites. And there's one other thing that I forgot to point out earlier, so I'll point it out now. There is a part of CERCLA, Section 120A2, which states that other agencies cannot adopt or use guidance which is inconsistent with EPA guidance. So that's part of the reason why we're showing you what EPA guidance says, what some of the other federal agencies might be using in their considerations, and identifying those potential disagreement areas, because essentially EPA is always going to come back to saying, yes, that's your guidance to the other federal agency, but CERCLA says that you can't adopt something which is inconsistent with EPA guidance. So all the more reason why our site teams need to work together to ensure that we're all in agreement on these groundwater decisions and how they're implemented. So with that out of the way, let's look a little bit at this DOE guidance. And my notes are all out of order, so excuse me for a second. So with this, you'll see that there's some designing optimal response strategies that are looking at the priorities. Is there current or imminent risk? The restoration evaluation for groundwater, making sure that the source control measures are done, evaluating those, and evaluation of MAPS reduction measures. So those are some strategies that could be used based on the DOE guidance. And it also considers, is technical impracticability something that needs to be looked at? What is the ultimate transition and exit strategy? And how do we better communicate groundwater response strategies? So DOE will get into looking at priorities across the site, looking at the imminent risk, and then trying to determine, well, how should we move forward? So that emphasis to order or prioritize the work based on risk rather than the broader lens of resource protection is a big opportunity for disagreement on how quickly the work should get done. As you can imagine, there's only so much money to go around. These are the priorities. Do the regulatory agencies, agree with that list of priorities? And if DOE is using this type of approach to make that order. So the focus on restoring groundwater to its high beneficial use really comes secondary to that prioritization based on risk. So while DOE looks at both risk and resource considerations, they are not approached in the same way. There is an emphasis placed on the risk versus the resource. So again, something to keep in mind as you're working on your site teams at the DOE sites for groundwater. We also wanted to touch base quickly on the DOD remedial optimization policy, and this is from 2012. So notice that the phrase of the language is different from what the EPA guidance says. For example, here, the DoD component shall maximize DERP effectiveness and minimize the DERP financial liabilities and environmental footprint. So EPA, we haven't mentioned financial liabilities or any term like that in the EPA document. So right off the bat, that's a very different, I guess, frame of mind to approaching the optimization effort for these groundwater sites. So again, lots of reasons why we may not agree. And then here with the DoD component, shall to the maximum extent possible identify specific environmental restoration objectives. So we're like, okay, what does that mean to the maximum extent possible? We understand these are site-specific decisions, and the phrasing in the manual is with the appropriate residual concentrations for each COC versus EPA would be using cleanup levels that the remedial action needs to meet. So again, just very different language that can lead to potential disagreement at your site. And I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Kate for adaptive management.
All right, thanks, Emmy. And thank you everyone for hanging in there for the last topic. I'm gonna talk about the use of adaptive management at groundwater sites. I'm going to talk a little bit about what adaptive management is from the EPA context, since we've been putting a lot of time, resources, and effort into better defining that, and then give you an idea of the ways that adaptive management can be applied at a site with contaminated groundwater. So before we get into this, what is adaptive management? And I think adaptive management is a really great way to end this training, because the concept of adaptive management really focuses on formal and systematic site planning and a management approach to do that. And what it does is it recognizes uncertainty, project risk management, and looks through rooted science and technology to move a site forward. So what adaptive management is in a nutshell, it is a project management approach. It focuses on planning and documentation of those plannings and ensures that decision documents are done consistent with CERCLA, NCP policy and guidance. I think one of the things for most people that are listening to this training today is you're probably saying, okay, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. There's a lot of decisions that are made throughout the CERCLA remediation process. You know, how do I use those to the best of my advantage at my site? And one of the wonderful things about CERCLA for a rule that was written 30 plus years ago is it set up a framework that has a lot of flexibilities that one can use. I think the challenge with using the flexibilities frequently is we tend to be more reactive in trying to use them than being proactive in planning for them. So really when in the context of groundwater sites, especially complexities or sites that aren't conducive to a final remedy decision, it's the concept of looking at your site, looking at a project management approach where you systematically collect data, update your conceptual site model, take actions where you have enough data and certainty to do those, recognize those areas where you still have the key data gaps, but learn by doing. So instead of studying a site and being in an RFS for 10, 15 years, using the flexibilities that CERCLA affords us, early actions, interim actions, treatability studies, to gain actual site-specific information and move us further through the remediation process. So I always like to think of adaptive management as taking a historic CERCLA linear process and using tools to collapse it upon itself. So you're always looking to reevaluate, question, and look at the information that you have to move the site forward. So one of the big issues that we have with adaptive management is folks tend to think that adaptive management is a new CERCLA policy, and it's not necessarily a policy in the fact that it changes any existing groundwater expectations for determining cleanup levels or determining remedy completion. So it doesn't circumvent the CERCLA policy or guidance process. It's also not, as I mentioned before, a reactive process. A lot of adaptive management examples that we use will be very reactive in, you know, I selected a remedy for pump and treat, then I went out, collected some data in the design, and then decided to change my remedy. So that was adaptive management. And that's more reactive. So I always call that trial and error. So again, it is not trial and error. It is proactive, not reactive. It's also not a one-size-fits-all. When I go into my next slides, I'm going to be talking about the application of adaptive management at groundwater sites from a very high level to a more targeted level. So that the concept of adaptive management and the management approach that can be applied can be done at a large site level for a big complicated site, or it could be done at a project level, maybe for an operable unit at a federal facility site, or even for a piece of the process, such as designing construction or remedy completion. So I'll get into that on the next slide. So adaptive management applications for sites with contaminated groundwater. I'm going to talk about three applications here, and it really sort of moves through the site remediation process. So one of the big lessons learned that we've had with the adaptive management pilots that we've been doing under the task force effort is planning and documentation is paramount. And the earlier you can do it in the process, the better. So one application for adaptive management is at the site level, or if your site's complicated in a federal facility world, the operable unit or area of the site level. And application of it early in the planning process allows the project team to sit down and put a lot of strategic planning and assumptions on paper. So one of the great things that comes out of proactive adaptive management and development of adaptive management plans early in the site management process is it establishes a site strategy that can consider the tools that I talked about with CERCLA that have flexibility. So does my site lend itself to using an early action to address, you know, risk? Do I want to use an interim action to do source control and see how the aquifer responds? So it's a lot easier to use CERCLA flexibilities like earlier interim actions in a site strategy when you plan for them in advance. That way, all stakeholders have an idea of what you're working towards, and there's not a lot of argument or disagreement. As I said before with the site strategy as well, it's amazing how many, I think a lot of times when we don't put things like site goals and strategies on paper early in the process, I think a lot of times there is perceived consensus, but not actual consensus or understanding on where you're going. So again, this more proactive and documented site level adaptive management puts these site strategies on paper and gets everybody on the same page. In addition, when you have a site planning process that looks at adaptive management and knows that you need to address data gaps, you need to take early actions or do treatability studies and learn from them to inform decision documents, it allows you to focus resources on taking actions where you can gain the right amount of information. So every activity that you do is planned for and it's strategic in collecting the data needed to move to the next step of the site strategy or the next big decision that needs to be made at the site. In the context of collecting that data, as I mentioned before, if you're doing a site strategy at a complicated groundwater site and you're using something like early actions, removals, remedial actions, or interim actions, it allows you, when you understand the site strategy and where you're heading, to target your monitoring and assessment of those actions to reduce the amount of time it takes you to get to the next step. I think a lot of times in CERCLA, when we do use early actions or interim actions, we sometimes don't think ahead as to, you know, this action is doing source control, but if I'm monitoring the effectiveness of source control, what types of data can I collect to answer some questions to get me to the next step? For example, can I collect lines of evidence information to figure out if M&A is a viable plume management strategy? Am I worried that, you know, attainment of my ARORs may not be technically practicable, so do I want to collect some information to maybe inform a TI evaluation? So again, this planning process targets data collection needs, is strategic in that targeting, and can focus and streamline resources in getting to those next decisions. So that's at the super high level for a site with contaminated groundwater. So another way to apply adaptive management is in remedy decision implementation. And the one thing that I want to clarify, and I think sometimes there's some language misunderstanding here, is that when we talk about adaptive management in the context of putting it in a CERCLA decision document, it does not change the expectations for what go into a ROD. They have to have remedial action objectives. You have to have a risk assessment. You know, so adaptive management in a ROD does not change what goes into a record of decision and what's required from a CERCLA, NCP, and EPA policy perspective. Instead, what it does is it looks at the tools that we have in the record of decision arena and figures out from a site strategy perspective which tool makes sense. Does it make sense to use a final remedy decision? Do we have the certainty to do so? If we don't, does it make sense to use removal authority? Does it make sense to use an interim remedial action? And then in addition, we also have the tools of doing contingency rods. So if we want to do targeted treatability studies to answer some key questions that might inform transitioning from one remedy to another, that is the way that adaptive management can be applied in a record of decision. Moreover, and some of the examples that you'll see when our adaptive management pilots come out, is we're also looking at phased remedy implementation approach. So you select a remedy for an area or a number of areas where you're doing source control activities or source control and groundwater activities, and maybe you're doing it in a phased approach where the design and the construction of subsequent phases within that technology that you selected in the ROD may be impacted greatly by things that you learn from the application of that remedial action at a first phase. So an example would be, for instance, if you were doing passive treatment for mine-influenced water, I know you guys don't have a lot of these at federal facilities, but if you were doing passive water treatment for mine-influenced water to try to achieve ARARs at a receiving surface water body, but you weren't sure exactly what type of treatment train you wanted to use, and you wanted to do an iterative approach to evaluate how you would design and implement different phases, that could be a component of adaptive management that went into a record of decision. But what we're trying to do in these adaptive management applications of a selected remedy is we're trying to put structure around the phased implementation or approach to a remedy. So establishing interim objectives for each phase is going to be critical, and then outlining what types of data collection, assessment, and timeframes you're going to need to move from one phase to the other. Likewise, if you were going to use something like an interim remedy or a interim remedial interim ROD, we want to see some of that monitoring and assessment and what timeframe would need to be expected to get to a final remedy. My last slide for adaptive management is in the context of site completion strategies. So I believe Kathy mentioned the groundwater remedy completion guidance document that came out in 2014. There was a sister document that came out at the same time that was called the Recommended Approach for Groundwater Remedy Completion Groundwater Remedy Completion Strategy Guidance. Sorry, I don't have the exact name off the top of my head. But really, if you look at that guidance, what it does is it takes a lot of the concepts that Emmy talked about in optimization and talks about a lot of that proactive and upfront planning that we talk about in adaptive management and sort of brings it together. So site completion strategies really are adaptive site management in the context of looking at a long-term groundwater remedy, the restoration remedy you're using in situ injections, you're using M&A, you're using source control and a combination of those multiple treatment trains. What it does is, again, it's proactive, it's upfront, it's planning, and it's documenting things such as site-specific remedy evaluations. That identifies the types of data that you want to be collecting over this long period of time, which can enhance long-term monitoring optimization. It requires the continued reevaluation of remedies, so you don't go into autopilot when you've constructed or implemented your remedy. You're constantly collecting data, you're looking at data, you're analyzing the data, and you're looking at it against site-specific metrics. Are my concentrations trending and a time frame that's reasonable? Do I have any indicators that additional source material is present? Do I need to go back and look at X, Y, and Z? So what the site completion strategies do in the context of adaptive management is it sets up that planning and that framework to really look at the site, continue to proactively manage it, and allows you to continue to question some of the assumptions that you had earlier in the process, and if needed, pivot and make changes using the correct CERCLA decision documents. So with that, I will hand it over to Jean.
All right, thank you so very much, Kate. I believe that we have a number of questions that are still in the queue, and we've got about 10 minutes or so left with our time today. So I'm going to start with one sort of broad question, and a number of people have asked about references and resources. So Emmy, I'll ask you, people have been asking for copies of the documents and the guidance. A handful of the URLs seem to be out of date. I've been trying to check them in the background as well. But is there a single place where you would recommend participants go to access related guidance or references for today's session?
So for the EPA guidance, we have our EPA groundwater page, which actually has everything we discussed and more on there. People really want to delve into all the EPA guidance. And I'll also make a point, if you didn't access the slides or print those out for your reference, each slide where a document was referenced includes its citation at the bottom, so you can figure out which document we were talking about throughout the entire presentation. So if you want to find something now, that might be the best approach. We could, Gene, if you think it's a good idea, pull out each of those citations and drop them into a PDF. As far as EPA's guidances, we know those links will be up to date. For other agencies, that might be a little bit harder, where we might be able to give you the citation, but if their link is bad, that will take longer to fix.
Okay.
So what do you think?
I think what we can at least do at a minimum is go through and try to highlight those for easy reference and at least post the ones that are still good. And I'll be working with you to reach out to some of the organizations that might have some bad links in there. And so I think we can get an updated list of resources for people and share that.
Okay.
All right. We also had some questions. I'm just going to try to jump around by topic here. There seems to be a desire for boundaries or a sense of when impracticability waivers or TI waivers need to happen. The terminology wherever practicable seems too broad for a lot of participants, and I've seen a couple of site-specific examples come into the queue looking for input if they would need a TI waiver in their case. So Dave, can you come in and perhaps provide some insights on that phrase, wherever practicable, what that means to many people?
Well, it's a tough one, and it really is site-specific, Gene, that what you really need to do is, you have to start with, Kate was hammering home one, and others, Kathy, this conceptual site model, that you have this idea, you have a plan, you have a strategy, you're looking at information, you're collecting information, and that information will lead you into a certain path, whatever it might be. It could be restoration, or it could be you start off in restoration and you go and find out that things are not just working out as they should based on the best approach you had, the best information you had collected, and the best conceptual site model. And it just is not going to work. So, TIs, for lack of a better term, are somewhat fluid. We don't jump into them too quick. Because we really do, if at all possible, want to restore, but we do acknowledge that there are cases that we just can't restore. So it's I don't want to say it's a live and learn type process, but, we do know that there are some really tough situations, and you can go ahead and, like Kate said, craft your data collection, craft your strategy and approach to collect the best information that would support that there is some portion of your site, all of it, none of it, shallow, deep, whatever it might be, that it's just not technically practicable to restore that groundwater.
Okay. All right. I think we'll jump over here to another question that we had brought up earlier. And Kathy, this question might be for you, but again, anyone can feel free to chime in on this one. So we had talked earlier about use and value determinations. The attendee noted if EPA has, quote, accepted, and they specifically say not necessarily, quote, approved, but they accepted a state's CSGWPP, are site or OU-specific groundwater use and value determinations required prior to evaluating or selecting a groundwater remedy with remediation goals that are based on that state's groundwater classification?
So I'm going to defer this to Dave Bartenfelder.
Okay. All right, Dave.
Okay. So the question, I think I understand it, but in concept, but I'm not exactly sure I understand real life how it's implemented. EPA accepting, we only have, as of right now, two options. The one is the EPA 1986-88 groundwater classification and the KISWIPs, where if the state has an EPA-endorsed KISWIP that doesn't have any exclusions, like Ben mentioned where in the endorsement it does not say, you know, we're not going to defer for remediation. So for those other states, if there is that endorsement, we would defer to the state. If the state program is more protective than what we would classify it, we can consider that. We generally would not consider a state classification that's going to be less protective than what we would have. So I'm not sure about this mechanism of EPA accepted, what that exactly means.
Okay. All right. Kathy, this might be one for you. Is groundwater considered a receptor under CERCLA?
So I believe that when we talk about receptors, we're talking about human or ecological receptors.
Mm-hmm.
So then I guess the question is, you know, how does the water that's been impacted by the contamination affect those receptors? And that's the risk assessment. So it maybe is indirectly, but I think that the linkage is to receptors, human health and ecological.
Okay. All right. Kate, this question is for you on the adaptive management approach. Is a 5-year remedy review a good place to use adaptive management?
So generally we recommend, so with adaptive management, we generally recommend the use of plans, so documented site strategies, roles and responsibilities. So a lot of times when we develop these plans, they require some time frame for review, you know, some cadence for review and updates. So some of the pilots that we've done, they've chosen to use the 5-year review process to look at some of the assumptions that went into their site strategy, and if things need to be updated, they choose to do it at that time. So I think it's a tool to look at some of the formal documentation you have from a planning perspective and see if that needs to be changed versus the 5-year review being a reason to do it. So we generally like to just sort of use it as a structured time frame to do reevaluation.
Okay. And this question, Emmy, you might have to help me direct this one, but one of the attendees wanted to know, would new remediation technologies evaluation be conducted through a focused feasibility study?
So a focused feasibility study could be used, I believe, to look at perhaps a new approach that wasn't available during the initial RI and FS effort. Ben or Dave, do you have thoughts on whether the focused feasibility study would be the appropriate way to do that?
This is Dave. I think it's a viable way of doing it. I think it serves a lot of good purposes. Focused feasibility studies are focused. So, like you said, you can bring in new information for a new technology and look at how it fits into the 9 criteria and this application at the site.
Yeah, okay, Dave, Emmy, this is Ben.
Dave, this is Kate. Sorry, Ben, go ahead.
No, you got it.
Well, what the other thing I was going to say is when you talk about looking at a new technology and you're talking about a groundwater system or challenges in a groundwater system, a lot of times some of the things that we do treatability studies for may be more a source control action than a groundwater action. So I think the scope of the activity and what you're looking at doing a treatability study for will best inform the CERCLA process or the CERCLA tool that you use to do that activity. So I think it really sort of, again, depends on where you're at and what you're looking to do a treatability study for.
Yeah, and I would echo that. You know, there's the DOD does the CERTA ESCTP program, and they're trying out something new at a site. You know, we're not going back and doing a focused feasibility study on that unless we're going to be using that in a future decision document. So.
Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time, what we'll do is we'll close out our Q&A segment right now. We've got just a few minutes left, and we do have a few final reminders. I wanted to check to see if Emmy has any closing thoughts that she'd like to leave the audience with before I offer those final reminders for our audience.
I just want to say thank you to everyone for participating in today's webinar. We hope you'll fill out the feedback form associated with this and let us know how we can improve upon it for our next offering. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders. I do want to echo those thanks that Emmy just had. We had over 340 people on for today's live delivery. If you're interested in learning more about these sessions and other information about cleaning up hazardous waste sites, I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that goes out on the first of each month. For those of you who would like to get a participation certificate, please know that you'll need to fill a brief online feedback form out to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, but make sure that you do two things when completing that form. Please be sure to check the box at the bottom of it certifying you were here for the entire thing, and then make sure your email address is entered correctly on that form. As soon as you submit it, you'll be able to then print out or download a certificate for your own records. This applies to those of you watching the recorded version of today's webinar. I have a link to the feedback form in the Q&A. You can also click the seminar feedback link under related URLs and press the Browse to button to open it up. So if you are replaying the recorded version, please follow those instructions to share your thoughts to get a copy of the certificate for yourself. And today's session was recorded just like the others in the series, so we'll automatically send you an email in about 1 week when that archive is available. As Emmy noted earlier today, you'll be able to download copies of the slides right now, and we'll work to get a more comprehensive resource list with some corrected URLs as possible. And as soon as that's been posted, I'll also be sure to notify everybody who signed up for today's session. You'll find that on the seminar resources or links